Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini, McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, we're going to hit the buffet of Chicago news. Anyone who lives here knows it's a dizzying carousel, from the president threatening to send federal law enforcement to Chicago, to the Bears possibly moving to the suburbs, minimum wage, to the mayor. Of course, we're joined by Chicago Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins to sift through all of it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ryan. And you're right. There's a lot to sift through. That's a crazy stew of issues right now being cooked up in the kitchen.
Yeah, as a legal show, we really appreciate the opportunity to talk to lawmakers like yourself. So let's jump right into the Air and Water Show. It was last weekend. I'm near the lake, and I heard this incredible, louder than normal noise. I was actually at the Cubs game on Friday that got a lot of attention. There was a couple of high rises on the north side that had their windows shattered, resulting in allegations that this was a sonic boom. The military denied that they went supersonic. Nonetheless, how did you and your colleagues view this incident? Should there be additional regulations? How should the city council deal with this loss of property and, you know, potential other issues from the Air and Water Show?
Yeah, we've been in touch with the Thunderbirds since the incident. You know, the Chicago Air and Water Show has a great reputation among air shows for a long time safety record. We don't want to blemish that. And we don't want to create a public relations disaster where they're denying responsibility. There's just no way that anything else could have been responsible for those windows being shattered, the large picture windows on Belmont. At the same time that they were practicing, it's pretty easy to infer a cause and effect relationship with the excessive noise from the F-16s and the damage. And by the way, I was at that Cubs game too on Friday. I was there with my wife, and we all know the trick that they do, which they do it every year. The Blue Angels do it too, where they get your field of vision to have you look over there when one of the jets goes rogue and comes from behind. And that's what they did in the seventh inning stretch at Wrigley. It didn't catch me off guard. I knew they were going to do it. But what caught me off guard was the sheer volume of the percussive sound wave. My wife woke up the next morning and said to me, "My ears are still ringing." And I believed her. You know, that was much louder than any air show I've been in. I've been going to the air show for, you know, 30 years in Chicago. There's no question something different happened this year. Now, if they want to claim that they did not go supersonic, and they have instruments that would document if they did, I'm going to take them at their word that they did not go supersonic. But they went about as close as you could to it, and it still caused an excessive amount of noise and potentially some damage. So they have to do the right thing. Don't make us litigate this. Just pay for the damage, apologize, and vow that it'll never happen again. We don't want to damage the sterling reputation of this air show by getting into a dispute over who was responsible and what really happened.
Pivot for a second to the Bears. As we know, the Bears are weighing both a lakefront domed stadium and a move to Arlington Heights. How do you think Chicago should approach reimagining the Soldier Field site and the surrounding infrastructure in the event the Bears ultimately leave?
Yeah, that's a great question. Soldier Field, it's no longer, you know, a national landmark because of the modifications, but certainly it's something that is so important to Chicago. Right up there with Wrigley Field, I can't imagine sacrificing it on the altar of economics. If the Bears leave, the challenge then becomes, what can we do to make that stadium viable, to at least have it generate enough revenue to pay for its own maintenance and have it be a break-even proposition? Seems to me that's possible with all sorts of other alternatives. Big Ten football, you know, you could have multiple games there. We could have more concerts. If the Bears weren't there, having that blackout on additional events from August until, you know, January, we could make a lot more money having other events in that facility. So losing the Bears would be tragic, but it wouldn't necessarily spell the end of Soldier Field as a viable outdoor venue. It just challenges us to program it a little more creatively. And I think we're up to the challenge. Having said that, I do not want the Bears to leave. I know that the Chicago delegation of the Illinois General Assembly is determined to block any taxpayer subsidy that would result in Arlington Heights being a more viable site for them. The Bears are valued at almost $9 billion. You know, it's a staggering valuation for the asset that is that team, but it disqualifies them for welfare, right? We can't give them a public subsidy. Now, having said that, I think we do have a role to play in government supporting, you know, the infrastructure, building the roads and the sewers and the power lines and all those other things that you would do for anybody, whether it was a sports franchise or an Amazon warehouse. It creates jobs. You want those jobs. So you're going to do your job as a government, but you stop there. No cash handouts, no operating subsidies, no gifts to them. And they still have to pay their tax bill too, once it's done, to support the school system. All that is a very high hurdle for them to clear with this Arlington Heights deal. I know they're trying. I believe them. It's not a negotiating ploy. They're really looking for a path to economic viability to build a brand new domed stadium in Arlington Heights. Personally, I don't think they can do it. And at some point, they're going to realize that, and they're going to come back to Chicago and say, okay, maybe we have to find a way to stay on the lakefront after all. If and when that phone call comes, I'll be ready, you know, and we'll have a conversation about keeping the Bears. Remember, we still have time on the lease at Soldier Field. They're going to be here for at least another 5 to 7 years, no matter what.
Bears are valued at $8.8 billion. Hard to get the taxpayers to kick in on that. Turning focus to minimum wage. The minimum wage in Chicago just got raised July 1st to $16.60. This is not just a Chicago issue, but one that many across the nation are dealing with. How are you answering your constituents, Alderman, those who are running small businesses who are obviously having to deal with this increased cost while, you know, facing incredible costs on their side and trying to, you know, deal with very small margins in that segment of business?
Yeah, absolutely. All the worst case scenarios that were, you know, we were accused of being doom and gloom merchants when we talked about the negative unintended consequences of raising the minimum wage to the extent that it is, and also eliminating the tipped credit for minimum wage in the hospitality industry. A lot of those unfortunate predictions are coming to fruition now, you know, and we're seeing other jurisdictions that did what we did a few years ago are now undoing it. Washington, D.C. repealed theirs. Michigan is looking to repeal theirs. I think Seattle as well is looking at it. It's turning out that it is costing jobs. You know, it's costing jobs. Go into McDonald's now and notice the few number of employees that actually work there. You have more kiosks and fewer employees. And that is the trend in other full service restaurants as well. So you get to the point of no return where, you know, restaurants just figure we can't survive if our cost structure for employment keeps going up out of our control. And yet automation now is providing a much more affordable alternative for them. It's predictable what they're going to do. They're going to eliminate jobs and go to automation. And we've unfortunately encouraged that with some of the policies that we've passed here. And it's time to stop it. We've lost some really good restaurants that have been in the headlines recently. Gale Street Inn is a great example of that. A beloved family institution that's been around forever. And it's exactly the kind of place that you would think gets hurt first by these types of costs that we impose on them. You know, they don't have a large national corporation of a structure that they could rely on to absorb some of these added costs. And they waved the white flag, you know, and surrendered. And that's tragic. So it's a direct result of some of the unfortunate policies that we passed as a city council and as a state legislature.
So Alderman, let's turn for a moment to what we've been watching happening in D.C. over the past couple of weeks. And with the Trump administration signaling that the same may happen in Chicago with respect to a more aggressive federal role in Chicago law enforcement, what do you see the city council doing in terms of protecting local control while still addressing public safety concerns?
Yeah, both the governor and the state attorney general have drawn a pretty clear line in the sand, you know, and they're not going to accept anything similar to what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. But frankly, I don't think it's actually going to happen. Now, that's not to say the bluster that we hear coming out of this administration can be dismissed. It can't be. The fact that they're comfortable enough rattling their sabers in a way that is clearly to me is so unconstitutional, it's almost laughable if it wasn't real. They're not going to follow through on it. It's not going to happen here in Chicago. But just the fact that we're actually having to have this conversation and respond to it, it should disturb all of us. It should be a very unsettling harbinger of what the future could be as this administration just careens out of control, towards a banana republic type of dictatorship. You know, if he ever does get full command of the military, you know, the way we've seen in, Central and Latin American countries in the last century, what would he do with it? You know, I think the answer is pretty clear. And we just have to be prepared to stop it however we can, whatever legal means. And it becomes more of a social issue than anything. Americans in general have to wake up and realize that now is the time to preserve the way of life that we cherish as a Western liberal democracy, liberal in not in the political sense, but in the characteristic sense of the type of government that we're comfortable with. That is in jeopardy right now because we have elected a president who's pushing the envelope farther than anyone ever dared to push it before. And his threats to come to Chicago with a militarized National Guard, as absurd as that sounds on its face, we have to take it seriously.
Alderman, last question. We only have about a minute left. In a new poll released a couple of days ago, Mayor Brandon Johnson had a 26% approval rating. When I asked you the same question I asked you when I ran into the gym, the gym we both go to, which, by the way, former Mayor Rahm Emanuel also goes to. Are you going to run for mayor when Johnson's term ends in 2027?
Yeah, I'm certainly not ruling it out. I think the key question is, will a moderate Democrat, a centrist Democrat with pro-business tendencies that describes me, will run for mayor? Now, whether it's me or someone who kind of checks those boxes, I'm prepared to support another candidate for mayor who would run the city the way it was successfully run. You know, Rahm Emanuel, for all the criticism he gets, that's how he ran the city during his two terms as mayor. That's how Rich Daley, for all the criticism he gets, ran the city for all those years. And frankly, the city ran pretty well. Even the critics have a hard time comparing today to back then and saying today the city runs better. It absolutely does not. So someone has to run for mayor and carry that banner. If no one else steps up to do that, then I'm just as likely as anyone else to jump in. But at this point, I do plan to run for another term as alderman and to support whoever that mayoral candidate happens to be.
And of course, should you run for mayor, you're going to come to Legal Face Off to make that announcement.
Yes, this would be a good place to talk about it.
We talked about the Cubs and the Bears. Who's going to go further in the playoffs?
Oh, yeah. Good question. You know, right now, the Cubs, they answered the call. I mean, to win those games against the Brewers. And I know I think first pitch is right about now. To start. Yes. This is a pivotal game for them. This will be a statement game. If they can beat Milwaukee today and narrow that gap to what I think they'd be, what, five games out if they win today? That is a strong, strong statement. So you can't count them out. I think the Cubs are poised. They've got some young talent now that really is showing some great potential. And I think they're going to they're poised to make a playoff run if hopefully they'll at least get a wild card spot. And it'll be some interesting fall baseball on the north side.
Chicago City Alderman and aspiring radio sports host Brian Hopkins. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Brian Burrow. The U.S. law firm Kelly, Dry & Warren was hit with a cyber attack back in March, allegedly exposing personal information of thousands of clients, employees, others associated with the firm. And now a class action lawsuit has been filed against the firm. Spencer Pollock is a member of the National Data Privacy and Cybersecurity Team at McDonald Hopkins, where he specializes in incident response and privacy consulting. And he joins us on Legal Face-Off to talk about this attack. Thanks so much for jumping on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Spencer, we appreciate it. So yeah, as Ryan mentioned, this week the news is that there was a proposed class action filed on Tuesday in New York State Court, alleging that Kelly Dry suffered a cyber attack, which is not really in dispute, but that it exposed names in March, dates of birth, social security numbers, and driver's license number, which the firm possessed. They say that this exposed thousands of current and former clients, employees, and others. So far, firm leaders at Kelly Dry have not responded. What makes, I mean, at the risk of asking an obvious question, what makes a data breach at a law firm especially damaging?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. The thing with law firms, we have very sensitive information. And it's kind of compounded upon, you have personally identifiable information, and then you have confidential information. And your clients really are expecting you to safeguard it to the best of your ability. And then the information that you're containing, obviously, when you're having conversations with your clients, they're sharing things that they don't want to become public. That's why we have the attorney-client privilege. So you kind of get two things stacked upon each other. You get the state and federal law, obviously, that dictate data breaches and regulations. But then you also get kind of the rules of professional responsibility, which you have to keep things confidential. So you have two layers of kind of expectations put on law firms, which puts us as a law firm at a tough position.
So Spencer, talk to us about the role that a breach notice plays in these sorts of situations and to what extent the breach notice issued here exacerbated the matter.
Yeah, so I mean, a breach notice is really there to serve to tell the impacted individual what happened, what was impacted, who the company is, basically why you're getting it from this company, and what people can do to protect themselves. I think that what people can do to protect themselves is the most pertinent part of that letter and what information was impacted. A lot of times these letters are going to be more high level because the problem is we live in a very litigious society. So the more details that are provided in that letter, the more exposed the company is. And a lot of those details truly aren't pertinent to help somebody protect themselves. So as long as we really have that kind of baseline information about if we're offering credit monitoring, get your credit report, fraud alerts, credit freezes, those are the kind of the most important parts to me rather than peeling the onion back too far. Because I think also you get too in the weeds, people are going to get confused and then not recognize the potential threat to their identity or financials.
So this firm, Kelly Dry, has about 300 lawyers. Not, of course, the first law firm that has been subject of litigation or cyber attacks. A couple of other examples. Last year, Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe paid $8 million to settle a lawsuit over a breach that allegedly compromised 600,000 people's personal data. Another firm that's based in Florida called Gunster in November of last year said it would pay $8.5 million to resolve a class action from a 2022 data breach. How are these damages calculated? What kind of potential exposure could this firm deal with? And why is it in the, you know, millions of dollars?
This is a great question. So we look at it, basically, it's going to be per head. So the more people in a class, obviously, the higher the amount of the settlements. None of these have gone to trial. So I really want to emphasize that. I don't know one going to trial and getting to a trial verdict. A lot will get to a judge, maybe get thrown out, or survive a motion and then settle. The reason for that is the liability is immense, especially when we start talking about statutory damages, right? So like the CCPA, the California Consumer Protection Act, has statutory damages in it. The biometric BIPA in Illinois, right? Statutory damages to it. So let's just take those two out of account. Let's just say it's just a data breach where it's the state law aspect. Usually we see between $10 to $30 a head, right? And how they've calculated that number, I have absolutely no idea. I think that's just where they found settlement values to lie. And so where you had the 600,000 people coming in around 8.5 million is what I think would be pretty usual. So Kelly's probably facing somewhere, I don't know how many people were impacted, but between $10 to $30 a head. A lot of that, though, is obviously the plaintiff attorney fees. That's a really big bulk of those settlements to go to them. And the big arguments plaintiff attorneys make, obviously, is that this information has been out there, it's been exposed, and now harm could come. If you are able to link, you know, identity theft to this, that obviously increases the settlement value because you have actual damages. But a lot of this is just speculative damages, which is a little uncommon in tort law because usually you'd have to have actual damages versus speculative, like down the road, something could happen. But a lot of the courts are letting that stand. So it really is based less on your information. Obviously, if the Social Security is impacted, then that could exacerbate the settlement. But the settlement values really are based on the number of people impacted, taking out if there's not statutory damages involved.
So Spencer, let's talk about claiming the stolen data was recovered for a second. Is that considered generally a strong legal defense? And are there other potential defenses beyond that for this type of an incident?
No, not in my opinion. And not if you ask my litigators who litigate hundreds of these cases, no, because I've talked to them at length about this. If buying back the data or buying a promise for deletion took away liability or significantly mitigated liability, I would probably pay ransoms in every single case. The likelihood here, it sounds like they did pay a ransom. Obviously, they didn't explicitly state that, but it sounds like they did. I don't have a judgment one way or the other on that. The likelihood that it gets to the dark web is pretty slight because, unfortunately, these criminals, they operate in their minds as a business and they have quote unquote reputation. So they're not wrong in their letter where they're stating they're pretty confident that this won't end up on the dark web or be sold. The problem is regulators and plaintiff attorneys turn around and say, great, you paid a ransom. It was still gone, and these are criminals, and you can't guarantee that this is not actually being sold, which Kelly Dreyer and anybody else who pays a ransom can't. I wish it was a way that we could mitigate liability, right? That we were dealing with legitimate entities here, but it's not. So I don't really see it as a mitigating factor, unfortunately.
Spencer, what should law firm leaders, many of whom watch and listen to our podcast that's celebrating our 10th anniversary. How should they react to this? I mean, obviously, this is not something new. Many of us have been dealing with this for years. And, you know, what's some of the checklist items? Obviously, you know, have the best security program available. Continue to update it. Make sure that your employees are adhering to it. You can have the best program in the world. If that one employee out of, you know, 1,000 clicks on that phishing email, you could be done. And also importantly, you know, check your insurance. I mean, once a claim hits, you got to have excellent insurance. You got to know your coverage. That's really crucial as well.
You hit on everything. You just took my talking points away. Congratulations on the 10th year, though, to start. But everything you just said is right. Let's start with insurance. You need to have cyber insurance. Look, general brokers are great. Commercial brokers, lovely. Go to somebody who specializes in cyber because they will get you a good policy. That's first. Second, as you said, you need to have the safeguards in place. Right? Start with the technical safeguards. Do you have multi-factor authentication? Do you have air gap backups? What's your retention policy too? You know, how long, you know, obviously different states have different requirements for law firms with retaining client files. I think it's between 3 to 7 years. We need to stop retaining those files after that time though, right? Email retention. don't have unlimited. I've represented many law firms who have unlimited retention in their emails, which is not a good practice. And then on the policy side, have an incident response plan and actually do tabletops and practice it. I don't care who you are. It's not if, but it is when that you're going to have an incident. People who are actually practicing this, so an average data breach costs about $4.2 million. Entities, including law firms that have a plan, have a team, and then practice it, save about $2.6 million. I think that number's actually gone up in the past 2 years in terms of savings and cost of a data breach. But we see that when I'm representing people that have done this. They are ready to handle the catastrophe and mitigate the damages versus people who have never gone through this. It's just exacerbating. And then, you know, have basically, yeah, the big part is to me, incident response plan, tabletops, retention policies, stop keeping things we don't need.
But I got one more question. Tina might have one more, but, you know, you work with lots of big companies, lots of big law firms. How damaging to one's brand and reputation can a data breach be? Aside from the substantive loss of data and all of the implications that you've talked about, it's crucially damaging to a law firm's reputation and brand when many of all of their clients are relying on, you know, security, confidentiality, privilege, all the things that can be lost with one of these breaches. Speak to that for a moment.
And you just hit on it. The three big problems of a breach: legal, financial, reputational, right? Reputational is one of the biggest things that we deal with when we get involved in a breach. You have to protect that, but you have to really protect the narrative. You have to be transparent and upfront, but you have to avoid speculation. You have to avoid putting the wrong message out there that's incorrect. Then that causes more concerns among clients and individuals. But yeah, losing clients is not unusual in these breaches, unfortunately, because you're right. There's almost a breach of trust. And what I tell clients, though, is that they really need to show there's before a breach, during a breach, after a breach. If you bring me in during and I haven't helped you before, or someone like me can't change that narrative. But you can show your clients during and after everything you're going to do to prevent it from happening again. Because you really got to say, once again, it's not if, but when. If the largest companies in the world, if the largest government agencies in the world can get breached, I don't care how large a law firm is, they can get breached, or a small. But it's what you're doing. It's all the reasonable steps you're taking to help mitigate that. That will give confidence and help your reputation.
Professor, do you have a podcast called Cyber Law Revolution? Am I correct?
I do.
Where can we find that? We love doing the podcast crossover here.
I appreciate it. So Apple, Spotify, Amazon, all the major ones. It is definitely a nerd pet project of mine.
Good. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off. Spencer Pollack.
Thank you all.
Don't forget to like, listen, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, marijuana is currently legal in 24 states, and now the Trump administration is looking into reclassifying it as a less dangerous drug at the federal level. Here to talk with us about it is Bruce Margolin, an attorney in California. He's the founder and director of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws. He's also got a book out called Down for the Cause, which you can buy on Amazon. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, should the federal government declassify marijuana, Bruce, how do you think that will affect people who are currently incarcerated?
In California, it did affect them. They were immediately able to be released upon filing a motion for the court. And so, I expect that will happen at the federal level as well. I'm hopeful it will be.
Even if marijuana is declassified federally, states like Idaho or Kansas may still prohibit it. How do you see conflicts potentially playing out between federal and state law?
They're going to probably give the states their own rights to decide whether they want to do that or not, whether they want to follow it, just like that's the way it goes. I mean, they give, right now, we have legal marijuana in many states, but then each state has the right to make their own decisions. But this, we're talking about the federal court to make their decision too. The feds can say we have a law that's different than the state laws. Right now, so we have in California, we have state laws that provide for us to have legal marijuana, but under the federal law, it's still illegal. And people in the business are still in jeopardy of being prosecuted by the feds.
Okay. What is declassification? What will that mean for the cannabis industry in terms of banking, taxation, interstate commerce?
Well, you know, Biden passed a change of Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 some time ago, but he left it to the DEA to enforce it, and they have done about nothing about it. So we're in a standstill when that came up. NIDA was supposed to have participated in this change, which gave this dispensaries to write off their expenses, but it hasn't happened. Nothing's happened that way.
Bruce, do you believe that the conversation we're having about declassifying marijuana is really about justice reform, or is it being driven more by political and economic interests?
I think it's Trump is talking the talk, but he's not going to do anything about it, to tell you the truth. Unfortunately, we can't trust what he says. Because 2 weeks ago, he said that he's going to consider reclassifying marijuana, right? 2 weeks ago. And he'll do it in the next 2 weeks. But from our experience of that past, that could be time. We don't have no idea if he's going to do anything about it. We just need talk to get people to think he's considering it. I don't think he's going to go anywhere.
Bruce Margolin, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off. The book, which obviously dives a little more deeply into the subject, is called Down for the Cause. You can find it online. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined by Jordan Rothman, founder and partner of the Rothman Law Firm, LLC, which handles cases in New York and New Jersey, including personal injury matters, commercial disputes, and class actions, among others. And from north of the border, Marc Olivier Bruyette. He's got the Canadian flag next to him. He's a partner in the insurance law group at Robinson Shepherd Shapiro. He's also a former Canadian Football League player and radio play-by-play commentator. Do I have that right as well?
That's correct. I'm on air tonight.
Fantastic. So you can join Rich with the Canadian flag next to you. All right. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
No problem. No problem. All right. So New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell has been indicted on federal charges. And Rich, it's linked to an alleged secret romantic relationship with a police officer of all people.
Yeah, Ryan, we've covered, and you've covered particularly longer even than us, the corruption in our state. Maybe second to Illinois is Louisiana, right? They have a long and sort of history of, you know, generally their governor is getting in trouble and kicked out of office. This is the first time a sitting mayor has been indicted, although most of us remember Ray Nagin, who was mayor during Katrina. When he left office, he got into some legal trouble. In this case, what the charges last week, Friday, LaToya Cantrell was indicted on many federal charges, basically resulting from her having an affair with a member of her security detail. Having an affair wasn't the issue, but the issue, Tina, was that she was taking trips on the government dime with him, spending, I think, $70,000. There was trips to Napa Valley. In a theme that we'll revisit today, Tina, and that we just covered, one of the lessons here is that technology will find you always. right? We've already covered the data breach story. We'll cover some of this later in our grab bag. But there was something like 15,000 WhatsApp messages between the two of them talking about their affair that basically did them in, right? I mean, it's the oldest story, one that we cover all the time. Like, there's no hiding from the stuff. If you think that WhatsApp, if you think that, you know, some of these other apps are not going to be discovered, they will. And that's what ultimately did her in. She faces up to 5 years in prison. Some of the other charges she can face up to 20 years. She has denied it. Beware of what you're texting, even on WhatsApp.
I mean, this is a really unfortunate story. In many ways, it's sad because I think her husband died during the affair. So there's that whole other angle to it. But agreed that given where technology is these days, you have to be really mindful. Just because you delete it from your devices doesn't mean it cannot be retrieved. I think people understand that on an intellectual level. But when it comes to them trying to justify their actions, doing things to try to cover their tracks, I think sometimes people forget some of the most basic things about how people can find you everywhere. Things you delete off your phone can easily be recovered. I think they could have bypassed a lot of this had they not used government funds to essentially subsidize their affair. And so, you know, I mean, that's just a real problem.
Yeah, Mark, among the 18 counts, the allegation is that not only did they use this app to discuss their affair and exchange pictures, audio clips, but they also used it to intimidate subordinates, to harass a citizen, delete evidence, lie to colleagues, commit perjury. I mean, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And from what I could gather as well, you know, there seemed to be some attempts to cover up some evidence as well. And both of them get their stories straight. And you know what? Through all of this, I feel for the city of New Orleans. Obviously, after Katrina, there was so much effort, so many people coming together to build that city back up. They host the Super Bowl last year. Everything's going great. And then you have the tragedy on New Year's, for which Mayor Cantrell has been partially blamed for some of the safety issues that were surrounding everything that happened during that terrorist attack. And now this. So you got to feel for the people of New Orleans. And I think it leaves them with a bitter taste in their mouth, especially when it comes to trusting elected officials and people in position of power, people within the government. Obviously, the American people have a lot of issues with that. And this story with Mayor Cantrell definitely doesn't help.
Yeah, Jordan, you're in New York. I mean, we skipped our Trump Watch segment today. We usually, over the last 5 or 6 years, lead our grab bag with Trump Watch. I really don't, even though we skipped it, you can't talk about anything really like this without, you know, speaking of Trump. And now you're in New York. Your mayor was indicted. There's just still discussion of Trump pardoning him if he wants to, if he's nice to him. What do you think the Trump angle is on this story, if any?
Oh, that's a very good point. You know, when I first read this story, and I've never seen the film The Bodyguard, but this sounds like the plot of a bad sequel to that film. But I think it's possible. You know, it's totally possible that Trump might find out that this is, or believe that this is, some type of lawfare, that, you know, it was a crime that didn't really hurt too many people, didn't involve too much taxpayer funds. The difference between this and Eric Adams would be that I believe this actually involved taxpayer money, whereas that was money from a private source. So I don't know if that's going to be compelling for Trump, but yeah, I definitely think this is going to be on his radar, and I guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah, just interestingly, Ryan, today, breaking news right before we came on was that the $500 million civil fraud fine in the AG in New York, Tish James case, was thrown out by the New York Appeals Court against Trump. So, you know, continues to win legal battles there.
All right, let's move on to the next topic. The woman known as the Ketamine Queen, now I have Billy Ocean in my head, has agreed to plead guilty to providing ketamine that led to Matthew Perry's death. Tina, you've been following this story out of North Hollywood.
So it happened earlier this week. Jasveen Sangha, the woman who's known as the Ketamine Queen of North Hollywood, who's been in custody for about a year, agreed to plead guilty to providing the ketamine that led to Matthew Perry's death in 2023. Through running a stash house out of her home. She had been set to go to trial next month. She's going to be pleading guilty to one count of maintaining a drug-involved premises, three counts of distribution of ketamine, and one count of distribution of ketamine resulting in death or serious bodily injury. She's also admitted to possessing various drugs with intent to distribute. Her home had been searched prior to Perry's death. Back, it was the March before he died, actually, where authorities uncovered kilos of various drugs, as well as various drug trafficking paraphernalia. According to the plea agreement, she admitted to working with Eric Fleming to sell 51 vials of ketamine to Perry the month he died, knowing that he was an addict. Those vials were given to Perry's live-in assistant, Kenneth Iwasama, who has also pled guilty for his involvement. He injected Perry with the ketamine hours before he died, and it's that ketamine that ultimately caused his death. It didn't help the people in this ring, the fact that they had some very incriminating messages, to Rich's point earlier, incriminating messages on Signal and various texts, where it was clear that they knew the authorities were investigating his death, and they made some very incriminating statements in the course of exchanging messages with each other. We've also covered the story involving the physicians that were part of this ring, Mark Chavez and Salvador Plasencia. Chavez pled guilty for his role in diverting the ketamine from his clinic to Plasencia. Plasencia went to Perry's home and injected him with ketamine and left additional vials for Perry's assistant to administer later. Earlier this summer, Plasencia pled guilty to 4 counts of distributing ketamine and helping to supply the ketamine that killed Perry. And this can actually, Rich, carry a total maximum sentence of 40 years in prison. So I think it's a really good thing that people are being held accountable for this. It's something we've been covering for a while. It's just extraordinarily sad. And we're seeing this happen with other famous people who are dying in connection with drug-related deaths.
Yeah, you know, again, like, you know, the flip side to Jordan being very cautious about what you put in text is, thank God we've got, you know, really aggressive prosecutors, mm-hmm. investigators. Not that it's that hard to find, but that Discover text, like, you know, in this case, does K, ketamine, stay in your system or is it immediately flushed out, was one of the texts. You know, it makes me think of another story. We didn't cover it, but, you know, that dentist who was convicted of killing his wife, poisoning his wife, he said she was suicidal. Meanwhile, he was texting, you know, how long does this poison stay in your system? I mean, if you do a little digging, you know, these people incriminate themselves. And we've had enough prosecutors on our show to know that that is obviously really compelling evidence of intent. When these defendants say, well, it was negligence or I didn't mean to, those texts are incredibly damaging. And once you prove that mens rea, you're done, Jordan. So, you know, I give credit to the prosecutors in this case for uncovering that and throw the book at her. You know, even though she pled out, she's going to serve a lot of time.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think this is just part of a sort of a track record among prosecutors to go after people who are responsible for deaths. I mean, you know, similar prosecutions happens for instance, Michael Jackson and other high profile untimely demises. So I think that this is, you can sort of fit this within that pattern. And I'm happy to see that action is being taken.
Yeah, Mark, I mean, there's no doubt that this is a trend that will continue, unfortunately, but hopefully this will put a bit of a dent in this and send a message.
Yeah, of course. And when you have people from Hollywood that are involved, I think it kind of magnifies the whole issue. I mean, obviously, there's a drug issue all across the United States, all across Canada. You think about oxycodone and everything that's going on with that. And then now you have a woman here in Miss Sanga who's obviously connected to those Hollywood circles. She's been connected to Charlie Sheen in the past. I think everyone's pretty aware of the demons that he has struggled with. And it's an unfortunate, you know, to see a guy like Matthew Perry get caught up in that. Obviously, he had his own demons to deal with. But for a lot of people in my generation who grew up watching Friends, you know, you kind of get it. You kind of get married to the idea of the character that you see on screen. But the reality is these are human beings. And unfortunately, there are vultures out there who will cling on to them and essentially, you know, suck the life out of them, for lack of better words.
Let's stick around with the celebrity world. Singer and actress Apollonia, who was famously in Prince's Purple Rain film, is now suing Prince's estate. Rich, this is over her name.
Yeah, I want to get Tina's take on this. Obviously, it's in her wheelhouse. But, you know, those of us from my generation, a little bit before Friends, grew up with Purple Rain being a big part of our lives. And, you know, the main female protagonist was a singer and actress named Apollonia, who was the co-star of that film, an artist in her own right. Now, Tina, she's alleging that Prince's estate is trying to steal her name in bad faith trademark proceedings. Basically, she's saying that she owns the right to her name and her image. And even if she signed that away, which is the response by the defendant, that the statute of limitations on this contract ended and that she should be able to not only use it, but of course, reap the rewards of it. And again, the allegation by Prince is a state. The defendant here is that she signed over her rights as part of the contract back in the 80s. Tell us why that argument that she signed it away in the 80s might not be a good defense, in your opinion, or whether it is.
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, it's obviously going to be very fact specific here. I think she's got trademark registrations that she owns, number one. Yeah. Number two, she's been using this for many years now. And the fact of the matter is that there may be certain limitations here at this point on their ability, their meaning the estate's ability to argue that somehow they're entitled to her her name. I mean, the fact that they let her get registrations for and that she's been using it as long as she's been using it, I don't think anybody's necessarily arguing that she's using it under license here. So then you start getting into potential issues such as laches, where if she was actually taking steps to use the name and going to the public, acting as if it's her own brand, and they knew about it and didn't do anything about it for years, there comes a point where their ability to do anything about it actually gets significantly circumscribed or maybe, you know, completely eliminated. So she's seeking a declaratory judgment that she's the owner of the brand. And so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I wonder why it's coming to a head now, so many years after she's been using this as her own identity and brand.
Yeah. Mark, the complaint says the following: all of the goodwill associated with the name and trademark Apollonia for the past four decades is attributable to plaintiff Apollonia. My response to that would be, well, not really, right? I mean, let's face it, Apollonia, even though, you know, you could argue that she's very talented, would probably be not very well known but for Prince using her in this film. I think it's a pretty good argument to say that while she might allege that the goodwill is from her, it's really from her presence in this one piece of art from four decades ago.
Yeah, of course. And obviously what Tina mentioned as far as it having been tolerated, however, by the estate for so many years, that'll obviously play into it. You know, this kind of reminds me a little bit of everything that's gone on in the NCAA with the NIL. And now you have somebody from a movie who's kind of making similar claims as far as her rights to use those trademarks and profit from them. But at the end of the day, you know, she signed up for a movie to play this character. And it'll be interesting to see which side the courts rule on. But I think one of the key aspects of this case will, in fact, be the period of time that elapsed during which, you know, there was nothing said by the estate. And all of a sudden they wake up one day and after having tolerated it for years, now all of a sudden they want to sound the alarms and shut her down. So we'll keep a close eye on it. But it's definitely going to be an interesting one.
Jordan, interestingly, not only does Apollonia allege that Prince never demanded that she cease using her name, she actually alleges that he supported her efforts and would have supported this lawsuit. Of course, he's no longer around. But that's kind of an interesting take.
Absolutely. It's going to be very fact intensive. And if she can advance a waiver argument, I think that would be very convincing. So I would really love to get my hands on the original agreement from the 80s that she signed. What she actually signed over, And, you know, if there's any type of defense that they could have in terms of waiver.
Ryan Burrow, by the way, I've told you this before many times, but I don't care where we go. I really don't care what we do. Just take me with you.
Good point. Yes, you've told me that many times, Rich. All right. No Trump watch this week, but we do have a Taylor Swift appearance, which on a podcast is always very exciting because you never know what's going to happen. Tina, the FTC is going after a ticket reseller for jacking up the prices of tickets on the Eras Tour.
Yeah, Ryan. So as everybody knows who's listened to LFO, we cover here on the show many times the recurring issues with regard to ticket selling platforms, particularly in the context of high profile artists going on tour. We've seen instances where there's cancellations of planned ticket sales due to an overwhelming number of ticket purchasing requests. And it seems like primarily the story has been about Taylor Swift recently. In the most recent iteration of this story, as Ryan mentioned, and in tandem with the crackdown that President Trump announced in March, earlier this week, the FTC sued ticket reseller Key Investment Group and three of its executives for allegedly evading purchase limits to buy thousands of tickets to live events, including Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, and reselling them at a markup. And they're alleging violations of the BOTS Act and the FTC Act. The allegations are that this reseller was able to do this by using thousands of Ticketmaster accounts, including fake and purchased accounts, and that for one Taylor Swift concert alone, they used 49 different accounts to purchase 273 tickets to evade a 6-ticket purchase limit. Key Investment Group had put themselves on the radar earlier this summer by suing the FTC to try to block its investigation, saying that its ticket purchases did not use automated software or bots and did not violate the Better Online Ticket Sales or BOTS Act. Rich, I mean, obviously there's a ton of money in this, and so we're just going to continue to see litigation, particularly when people's ability and the market and in terms of buying tickets and the market for these tickets is significantly interfered with.
Yeah, I mean, again, technology, you know, not in the same context as our other stories, but, you know, it's a game changer. Obviously, when it comes to this area, it really makes it easier to do what is alleged here. But I thought we were talking about the Taylor Travis podcast the other day. Everyone watch that one? are you among the millions who watch the podcast, Mark?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to squeeze it into my schedule just yet, but I'll get around to it eventually. Mark, I'm sure my daughter will want to watch it with me.
Mark, as a fellow professional football player, how does Travis Kelce's behavior play over in locker rooms? I mean, the guy looks much different than he did a couple of years ago. I mean, God bless him, but, you know, he's trying on lots of different outfits. As long as he performs on Sunday, I guess, which hopefully he'll continue to do.
Yeah, you got to think that he's hearing about it from his teammates, this glow up of his since he's latched on to Taylor Swift. But the truth is, I mean, it's catapulted him to another level of stardom. You know, he was obviously a very good football player already, but I think his relationship with Taylor Swift has brought him, you know, up to the next level, not necessarily for his play on the field, but just what he brings to the media and pop culture in general. And people are fascinated by it. You know, I think people always love what's going on in celebrity relationships. But when you have two worlds collide, the biggest music artist in the world, along with an athlete that's playing in the most popular professional sports league in the world, you're obviously going to get a lot of reactions. But within the confines of that Kansas City Chiefs locker room, I can imagine that he's getting it from everyone.
Hey, but he's still not as good as Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, our fellow French-Canadian former professional NFL player who went into medicine.
Yeah, I did. Kelce actually has CFL connections. His roommate at Cincinnati was Zach Caleros, who's the starting quarterback for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, who was actually be playing tonight here in Montreal against the Alouettes.
See that? We've got it to CFL face-off on WGN, Ryan.
It's the podcast he's on. By the way, Travis Kelce perhaps up for an Oscar for his role in Happy Gilmore 2, We'll have to see if that plays out. All right, we've got a new airline lawsuit over windows, Rich. What's this all about?
Yeah, just filed this week. The allegation against United and Delta, Tina, is that they are selling seats to consumers as window seats. But when these consumers get on the plane, they are not facing windows. They are next to just the wall. And, you know, the allegation by this purported class is that it's deceptive and they are, you know, not getting what they are paying for. Increasingly, we're seeing lawsuits with airlines, you know, as they try to drive margins, and they're all dealing with record profits right now, all these airlines. And the allegations continue to be that airlines are, you know, nickel and diming and deceptively promising things that consumers are not getting. And in this case, the allegation, like I said, is that you're paying for a window, you're not getting a window. It's particular to these two airlines as they use allegedly these planes that don't exactly have the window next to it. Some are even alleging that this is a medical issue because they can't, you know, they have anxiety and fear of flying and they can't look out the window as they paid for. So, you know, it might seem silly. On the other hand, when you're paying that extra, we've all come to that screen on the map when you're buying your ticket and everything costs more, including your choice of seats. If you're paying an extra $90 for a window, you want a window. So I get it.
I get it, Rich. And, you know, I agree with you that some people might find it silly, but in the day and the era where, again, technology enables, I think, sellers online to be able to be super specific in terms of figuring out, like, and conveying to the public what they're getting. You know, I think that this is something that is not necessarily crazy at all. And I also think that there are other airlines that have successfully, at least based on what I understand to be the case, that there are some airlines that have actually successfully conveyed to people when they are buying seats, whether or not those windows exist. So in other words, they're not being charged. They're being delivered the information that there is no window at what one would ordinarily consider a window seat and that the price is being adjusted accordingly, which I think is one of the more important facts here, that competitors are making these adjustments.
Yeah. You know, we're seeing Southwest Jordan change their longtime policy of, you know, no assigned seats to assigned seats that increase revenue. The numbers in this case are allegedly that United and Delta have sold at least 1 million windowless seats. As lawyers, we always look at damages, right? So even if that's the case, are there really damages here? Is someone really damaged by not having a window?
That's really interesting. Yeah. You know, this is actually, in my opinion, these lawyers are doing the Lord's work. All right. And this is why, seriously, this is why class action lawsuits are great, because obviously you have numerosity. And, you know, the question is how much damages there's going to be. I think they're going to be able to get over 5 million. For the Class Action Fairness Act. So, I mean, it's definitely good that this is like a class action. This is the type of thing where there's not that many damages individually, but in the aggregate, there's a lot of damages. And I definitely think that this is going to lead to a settlement. This is going to lead to a class that's going to be certified as a class. And we'll see. I mean, I think the thing with class actions is sometimes the lawyers benefit more than the people who are wronged. We'll see how much each individual person who didn't get a window in a window seat gets, but it's good because maybe this will lead to policy change and people will think that they've got a sense of justice.
There should be a lawsuit. You know, I flew yesterday and Ryan, the flight attendant gave me that little Biscoff package, which I love, but I don't eat, right? I just can't eat it. So as they were walking back the aisle, I said, "Will you take this back?" It was unopened. And the flight attendant just said, "Well, just leave it there." That's why costs are going up. They're wasting these unopened Biscoff cookies, man. Take those back.
More Stroop waffles. Need more Stroop waffles. I'm a Stroop waffle guy myself.
Yeah. I will say the variety has gotten way better than the standard peanuts and pretzels.
All right, let's move on. Tina, Chinese hackers are now going after the LSAT.
Yeah, Ryan. So earlier this week, the Law School Admission Council, or LSAC, they're the entity responsible for the LSAT, they announced that they're becoming increasingly concerned by concerted efforts in mainland China to cheat on the LSAT, as well as other standardized tests. And they claim in an effort to try to nip these folks in the bud. They said as they continue to work on security measures that they have in place for the administration of the test, that they're going to suspend online testing of the LSAT in mainland China after the October test, which is coming up pretty quickly. The issue here is that there is no in-person alternative currently available in mainland China to take the test. So until the council is able to address what they are saying is a pervasive cheating problem, the October test will be the last LSAT in mainland China until further notice. What's interesting about this story is that there's some speculation that this could actually just be an effort to curb law school applicants currently coming to the U.S. from China. And there's also some speculation that the council announced this story to detract attention from a lawsuit that was filed against it earlier this month in Pennsylvania, alleging anti-competitive behavior through price fixing for the law school application fees that the plaintiffs are alleging the council is colluding with member law schools for and paying kickbacks to those schools. There are over 75,000 people, Rich, who apply to law school each year, and each of them have to pay what's considered a mandatory subscription fee to the council of $215 and $45 per report that they order to apply to law school. The council allegedly collected $93 million in these fees over just the last 3 years. And for a nonprofit to say they've got about $250 million in net assets and a CEO making over $1 million, you've got people speculating that this is the real reason why the council came out with this edict earlier this week.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they ought to add a new question for the LSAT, apparently, dealing with identity verification. Who knew? And, you know, perhaps in light of some of the other stories we're covering today in other shows, you know, it's just a trend, you know, cheat your way into law school and then that'll teach you how to cheat your way into practice. So it's no doubt a trend. That technology is great. It's being used in lots of positive ways in our field, but it's also being used, Mark, in ways that are unfortunate, but actually predictable.
Yeah. And when I heard China was involved, I put on my tinfoil hat because, you know, you start looking at the bigger picture and perhaps a conspiracy theory to the effect where China is now trying to get young law students over to the U.S., have them be successful in law school, get those prize jobs in big law or in the government agencies, whatever the case may be, and use them as assets for overseas intelligence, whether it be espionage or whatever the case may be. So I said, I found it very particular that this issue seemingly is, or at least only China is being named as having been involved in that.
Jordan, it's actually harder than ever to get into law school. Applications are at an all-time high. Waiting lists are all over the place. I know lots of people who got pretty good LSAT scores that can't get in. So this even adds to the confusion there, I think.
Yeah, it's a really horrible situation when there's widespread cheating. And obviously, it leads a lot of American students to feel like they're being cheated themselves. It is interesting. I actually think I was wondering myself, why would there be this cheating in mainland China? I think, Mark, that's an interesting hypothesis. I think that might have some legs. It's just going to be interesting to see if anyone actually succeeded in cheating, if they're going to take spots or what the eventualities are going to be because of this.
Well, we've got a lot of high profile people here on this podcast. Mark, have you ever pulled the do you know who I am? Anyone? Don't you know who I am? Have you ever blurted those words out?
No, but my kids have, even though they're only 11 and 7, they have said, my dad's a lawyer.
There you go. There you
classic
go.
Classic trap boy behavior.
Well, a prosecuting attorney from the Rhode Island Attorney General's office was arrested, caught on tape yelling at police, and Rich, he was warning the officers about arresting her.
Devin Flanagan saying the words, I'm an AG. I didn't have time to count the numbers, but I heard at least like, I don't know, 9 times the words, I'm an AG, which of course is attorney general, or in this case, a special assistant attorney general. We got to just go right to the video. Let's go to the video, listen to some of this interaction, and then we'll talk.
Okay. No, I understand you don't want to deal with it, but the protocol is, and your protocol is, if I ask you to turn off the body cam, you have to turn it off, and that's your protocol.
She's a lawyer, so she knows.
Well, that's lawyer stuff, so that's not true. So we got to go.
No, it is. That's law.
I'm an AG. I'm an AG.
Good for you. Let's go. We're going. We're leaving.
Please don't put your hands off.
Can you get your children out of here? Like, I don't know why.
The one part that's my favorite is the last "I'm an AG" stops at "I'm an A" because he slams the car door on her. "I'm an A." I don't know if you guys get it. She's an AG. So presumably the law shouldn't apply to AGs. And her friend, what you didn't hear also is her friend, who was also charged, said she's a lawyer many times. She's an effing lawyer. Oh, well, you should have said she's an effing lawyer, in which case everything's dropped. Bad on us. Tina, technology, it's just common theme. Cameras everywhere. All these cops have body cam. I'm obsessed with watching body cam videos. They're all over my feed. My algorithm loves the body cam footage, because it doesn't lie. It shows you who you really are. And also, when in the history of crime has anyone ever benefited from the sentence that begins with "I am blank"? Right? Unless you're saying "I am guilty, take me away," you using your name, title, position, company in an effort to evade justice never works out. Always makes you look like the fool that this person is. By the way, the attorney general learned of this, and to his credit, usually, you know, there's no comment. They back there. This AG came right out and admonished this person. They're probably fired by today, but they also said that they made her watch the video together like she was some 8-year-old. So, but yeah, she the biggest punishment she'll get is just public discord forever for trying to use her position to influence justice.
I mean, the resisting of arrest is always a mixed bag, right? But in the era of technology and body cam, it's even more so. I don't know if you caught the video of her friend being put. Oh, my God.
She slipped out of the cuffs.
The one that we watched was nothing compared to her friend being put in the car. It was unbelievable.
She wasn't an AG. The difference was she's an AG. AG, no AG. Jordan?
Well, you know, I write for Above the Law, and I got to tell you, every year or two, there's an article like this. This is not an isolated incident. I remember, you know, in New Jersey, where I live, we had a Port Authority commissioner flash her badge to try to get out of a ticket. I remember there was an article about a Miami prosecutor who was guilty of the same thing. So I don't really understand why this happens year after year, time after time. But you know, I guess as long as there's people who may be under the influence, I don't know if this person was, and thinks a lot of themselves because their legal background, this is going to happen.
Yeah. Mark, my other favorite part of it was where she says, "I want you to turn your body camera off. Protocol is that you turn it off. It's a citizen request to turn it off." Oh, really? Is that a thing? That if someone being arrested doesn't want to be videotaped, you can ask the cop to turn it off? That's called a citizen request? Oh, well, you should have said so. That'll mean that no one ever is videotaped if you can just say turn it off.
Forget about it. I'm an AG. She should have said I'm a super lawyer. I think I would have held a little bit more weight. And to what Jordan said, I don't know if you noticed in the video, but there's a big sign behind that says Wine Bistro. So I'm going to take an educated guess and say that she wasn't in there working on her files. Alcohol was likely involved in the events that ensued. But, you know, obviously there's a sense of entitlement there, you know, and hopefully, you know, she can land back on her feet. It was a moment in time. You know, there's no indication that she's a bad person. And so hopefully she learns from all of this and she can get her career back on track. And I know that next time I'm given directions by an officer or law enforcement personnel, you know what? Just follow. Cool down the situation, have a discussion, try and keep your emotions in check and keep your bar card in your pocket.
So I went to get the cap of my alma mater, McGill University, who has a pretty good football team. Mark, where did you play college football in Canada?
On the other side of the mountain at the beautiful University of Montreal.
Our rival. All right, well, we'll end the show. We always like to get to know our guests a little bit by throwing them a question that they didn't know in advance. Since we talked about Apollonia, the loss to Purple Rain, let's ask you, of course, Prince is deceased, one of our favorite artists. Who is your favorite artist that is no longer around? Now, we've covered on the show the value, Tina, of the IP. In many cases, the IP value of a lot of these artists is greater when they are deceased than when they're alive. They continue to drive huge revenue. So we'll start with Jordan. Jordan, like Prince, and it can't be Prince, who is your favorite artist that you still enjoy that is no longer around?
I got to go with George Harrison. Does that count? He's got to count, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Good one. What's your favorite George Harrison song?
I've Got My Mind Set on You. It's not that one. That's not a good song. Probably While My Guitar Gently Weeps. That's a good one, right?
Absolutely. Also the subject of litigation, by the way. Mark, favorite deceased artist? It doesn't have to be a musician, by the way. It could be an actor. It could be anyone.
You know what? I think we do have a New Yorker in the house. I think I'm going to go with Biggie Smalls, the Notorious B.I.G. He's got a great catalog, still a lot of bangers that even the kids these days are listening to. You've got artists right now who sample a lot of his stuff as well. So a legend that was gone too soon in the rap game.
But wait, is he really dead? That's the question. Ryan Burrow, favorite
kid
celeb.
I'm gonna kind of go off the beaten path here. Bradley Knoll was the lead singer of Sublime and died actually before his songs became big hits. And now his son has picked up the torch and sounds just like his dad. It is wild. It almost feels like the entire band's been revived. It's crazy.
That is a deep cut. Tina Martini, favorite deceased celebrity.
That's tough. I mean, if we're sticking with music, I'd have to say John Lennon.
Favorite Lennon song, go.
I love Imagine, but there's such a great catalog, him solo as well as him with the Beatles. So
strong Montreal connection, Mark, to John Lennon. Of course, did his famous love-in at the Queenie Hotel in Montreal and was photographed in bed with Yoko Ono for one of his albums. Lisa, what do you got? Favorite, John Lennon's a good one. Favorite deceased artist?
I'm going to go recent with Ozzy Osbourne.
There you go.
Oz, absolutely. Really? Crazy train. I'm going to go with Keith Richards as my favorite dead celebrity.
Wait a minute.
Keith Richards is dead, right? He died like in the 70s.
No? Very funny.
Zombie.
Perhaps should be dead. Actually, my favorite is Clarence Clemons, you know, saxophonist for the E Street Band. Amazing, gone too soon, but continues to live in perhaps the legacy of his nephew, Jay Clemons, who's in the band.
There you go. So the legends live on. All right. Thank you so much, Marc-Olivier Bruyette, Jordan Ruthman, and that will do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Chicago Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins, attorney, author, and marijuana law advocate Bruce Margolin, and Spencer Pollack with the National Data Privacy and Cybersecurity Team at McDonald Hopkins. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall, for Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thank you again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.